A Saudi teenager's new home today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. 18-year-old Rahaf Al-Qunun fled her conservative Saudi family by boarding a flight to Thailand. Now she has a new home in Canada, and some say that's a win for the Canadian government.
It really does allow us to, walk the talk of being a feminist government and having a feminist foreign policy agenda.
Meanwhile, in Saudi Arabia, some say that the teenager now in Canada doesn't speak for everyone back home.
One person doesn't determine the whole country.
Plus, the conflicted relationship between Donald Trump and the Presidential Records Act.
This business with the interpreter's notes is not the first time President Trump has tried to push the envelope, shall we say, or rip up the envelope.
Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. America's top diplomat already had plenty to talk about during his visit to Saudi Arabia. Iran, Yemen, and Syria were all on the agenda. Then, right before Pompeo landed, his boss took to Twitter. President Trump threatened to devastate Turkey economically if the Turks attacked America's Kurdish allies in northern Syria. Pompeo was asked about that today in Riyadh.
I don't think it changes the president's decision for our 2,000 uniformed personnel to depart Syria.
Pompeo said the U.S. will continue to work with allies to stabilize the border area between Syria and Turkey.
We want that to be a place where there isn't violence, as there's been over these past years. We want into a good part of that region. There are still, depending on how you define the region, there are still millions of displaced persons in that region, too. We want to take that violence level down so that we can begin to return the displaced persons to that region as well. I actually think the president's remarks are pretty clear about what America hopes to achieve in these conversations with all of the parties, the Turks certainly included amongst them.
This was the second time Pompeo visited Saudi Arabia since the murder of U.S.-based journalist Jamal Khashoggi. Pompeo said the Trump administration is expecting the kingdom to hold accountable, quote, every single person. The secretary also said he talked with Saudi leaders about reports of women's rights activists being jailed and tortured, but he did not go into detail. Another story that's put Saudi Arabia's human rights record in the spotlight, an 18-year-old Saudi woman who fled her home country, saying her life was in danger. Rahaf Al-Qunun got on a flight to Thailand. She tweeted about her ordeal and got attention from around the world. Rahaf was granted asylum in Canada, landed there over the weekend, and she got the red carpet treatment.
This is Rahaf Al-Qunun, a very brave new Canadian. And Rahaf wanted Canadians to see that she's arrived at her new home.
That's Canadian Foreign Minister Chrystia Freeland welcoming Rahaf into the country. She stood with her arm around the teenager at the airport in Toronto. Besma Momani is a professor of political science at the University of Waterloo and Balsillie School of International Affairs. What was your reaction to Canada granting Qunun asylum?
I think it's a win-win for the Canadian government and for Canada's reputation overall. It really does allow us to walk the talk of being a feminist government and having a feminist foreign policy agenda. And certainly many of us, even in the academic space, have been kind of wondering, what is a feminist foreign policy agenda? It hasn't been really clear. So I think it's allowed the government to really sort of take a win on all accounts.
Well, no doubt that there's a warm welcome in Canada for Rahaf Al-Qunun. She said her life would have been in danger if she had to go back to her home country of Saudi Arabia. It sounds, as you say, like a good news story, especially if you're Rahaf, but it's also a complex political story, isn't it?
It is. Bilateral relationships have been already tested. We had an incident last August whereby the Canadian government, both the Minister Freeland and our embassy in Riyadh, had sent out a tweet that basically condemned the Saudis for their poor human rights record. And we saw the Saudi government react really quite remarkably by stopping all foreign direct investment, that's Canadian FDI, into Saudi Arabia. They recalled 16,000 undergrad students to come back home to Saudi Arabia and really just effectively stopped all real diplomatic negotiations and recalled their ambassador and the same for ours.
The ambassador, the Canadian ambassador who was expelled by Saudi Arabia was Dennis Horak, and he warned about diplomatic fallout in, as you say, an already bumpy relationship. There's also David Chatterson, another former ambassador, who said this.
I think it also sets a very dangerous precedent, which is, what happens the next time a teenage girl or adult woman from Saudi Arabia that flees her family and declares herself to no longer be a Muslim.
So, Besma Momani, what do you think? Does it set a dangerous precedent?
In a way, it does, although I would point out that Canada's acceptance of Rahaf's case is unique in that we also believed she was a victim of domestic violence. That's really the essence of why she was expedited. It's not because of her gender, and it's not because of her renouncing her faith, although the latter will, of course, open her up to potential political backlash by the regime in Saudi Arabia, which sees that as blasphemy. So I think there is some warranted truth to it. But, you know, Rahaf is not the first. I mean, this has been done by Saudi women for a very long time. Certainly, this is not new. I think the post-Khashoggi sort of climate, that's the journalist that was murdered in Istanbul, has raised, I think, the global consciousness of sort of how Saudi Arabia deals with its dissidents and how kind of cruel and awful it can be for those who are returned to the country or who are dealt with by the intelligence service.
How important, then, is it for Saudi women what Rahaf has done and what Canada has done for her?
Well, again, Rahaf is a bit, I think, controversial. Her renouncing her faith has made it more difficult for even, I think, Saudi women who are sympathetic to Rahaf's experience. She's allied herself with some very controversial figures, I think, groups like ex-Muslims and so forth. And certainly she has every right to choose to have no faith at all. But I think the manner of which she's allied herself with some groups is going to make it difficult for her to get that kind of wide support in the country for her particular case. That said, the discussion about guardianship laws, and particularly where there is domestic violence, and certainly not all Saudi families are abusive, but there is going to be domestic violence in Saudi Arabia like there is anywhere. And when you are now also seeing your abuser being your guardian, it's ever more difficult. And so that's an issue that I think all Saudis are concerned about and hopefully, I think, wake them up to want to do something about this internally.
Besma Momani is a professor of political science at the University of Waterloo and Balsillie School of International Affairs. Thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you.
Coming up, the UK has been fighting over Brexit for more than 2 years, but there's a real deadline looming. Tick tock, tick tock. That story's next here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. The B word. You know what I'm talking about. Brexit. This week is another big one for the British attempt to leave the European Union. If you feel like we've been here before, it's because we have. In the next 24 hours, the UK Parliament is holding yet another so-called crucial vote on Brexit. Rob Watson, the BBC's UK correspondent, is at Westminster to try and explain it all for us. I feel like we've had many moments where we hear, this is a very important week for Brexit, another key vote for Brexit. So avoiding the boy who cried wolf pattern, get us excited, Rob, about this coming week in Brexit. What's on the cooker and what is this week's deadline all about?
Well, it's right that you should raise it in that way. And I think I'll come to it in 1 second. But absolutely, Marco, it's not really boy crying wolf. I mean, I think it's important to tell everyone that Britain is in and has been for some time in a profound political crisis. And that is because the 2016 referendum was like a quasi-revolution, as one Conservative MP described it. And since then, basically, British politicians simply cannot agree on what to do about the result of that referendum. Now, the reason why this big vote on Tuesday matters is that this deal that Theresa May has negotiated with the European Union, which is profoundly unpopular in Parliament and beyond, this will be the moment at which it gets tested, just to see how unpopular it is with MPs and therefore what on earth might happen next.
Is it essentially the same vote as December? What's May offering differently this time around?
Very little. I mean, it's absolutely the same since it was December the 11th that she ducked out of it. I know, because I was standing there outside Parliament waiting. I mean, the thing that's really changed since then, let's be brutally frank about it, is that the clock has ticked down a bit further towards Brexit on March 29th. And of course, Theresa May, I think, will be hoping politicians will be so panicked that much as they don't like her deal, that they'll think that all the alternatives, maybe no Brexit at all, or Britain leaving the European Union without any kind of arrangement or deal, are so dreadful that eventually MPs will get behind her. I have to say that so far, there's not much sign of that.
Yeah, okay, so unlikely that any MPs will change their mind and vote with her this time.
Some maybe, but I think she's still looking at a pretty thumping defeat.
Rob, if you were to play the role of a European parliamentarian right now, what words would come out of your mouth to describe what's happening on the other side of the channel in London? Words that you can say on radio.
I'm glad you added that bit, Marco. Look, the view in Europe is that Britain has gone crazy. That European Union membership, as they saw it, suited Britain very well. It had a much more distant relationship with the EU than the rest of the countries. It wasn't part of the single currency. Britain had benefited hugely, as they would see it, from attracting so many millions of talented EU citizens here. Britain's economy was sort of growing faster than the EU economies. I mean, I guess it could be summed up, the EU were thinking to themselves, hang on a minute, what's not to like for Britain? So that they think Britain is going pretty crazy, and I think their patience with Britain has worn pretty thin. I think they started out as being rather sympathetic, and now they're like, oh my goodness, get on with it.
My colleague at the BBC, Rob Watson, their UK correspondent, speaking with us from Westminster. Rob, always great to talk. Thanks.
Thanks, Marco. You too.
We've got our own high-stakes political showdown going on in Washington, of course, but apart from the shutdown, the new Democratic majority in the House is giving some people hope on one thing, climate change. Climate activists, younger ones in particular, are pushing an updated version of an idea that transformed America in the 1930s. They're arguing for a Green New Deal. Here's the world's Carolyn Beeler with a look at the group behind it.
The idea of some kind of Green New Deal has been kicking around for about a decade, but it started making headlines recently because of the progressive star Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez.
This is going to be the great society, the moonshot, the civil rights movement of our generation. That is the scale. That is the scale of the ambition that this movement is going to require.
In November, the incoming representative from the Bronx outlined her vision, a massive green jobs and infrastructure program to make America greenhouse gas neutral in a decade and guarantee any American who wants one a job along the way. Like just about anything Ocasio-Cortez does, her call for a Green New Deal got a lot of attention.
She has a Green New Deal that would eliminate much of the United States' fossil fuel consumption.
A Green New Deal. Remember that term, a Green New Deal.
What she calls a Green New Deal related to climate change.
But Ocasio-Cortez might never have pushed for the idea if it weren't for the group behind it, called Sunrise Movement. Sunrise was started in 2017 by recent college grads fresh off of climate organizing on campus. Varshini Prakash was one of the six co-founders.
All of us were feeling this sense of unease and frustration that the hurricanes were getting bigger, the fires were getting bigger, but our movements weren't growing with them.
The movement's signature idea was the Green New Deal, to move America off fossil fuels by creating millions of green jobs.
We really see it as not just a climate policy, but a socioeconomic project to rival some of the greatest projects in American history.
We got the right.
The idea landed on the national stage in November when members of the group staged a sit-in in the office of Democratic leader Nancy Pelosi.
They try to stop us, but we keep coming back.
Interest in the group has soared since then. It's added 100 new local chapters since November, and roughly 1,300 people joined the group's first strategy call of the new year.
This year, in 2019...
This is the Sunrise Movement's Will Lawrence talking about pushing politicians to take a stand on the Green New Deal this year.
Because everybody who is not with us, we need to kick out in 2020 and elect champions who are going to stand for the Green New Deal. And if we do that, we have a window of opportunity to actually pass this thing in 2021.
So far, likely Democratic presidential contenders, including Elizabeth Warren and Cory Booker, have supported the idea. That's even though its goal of eliminating greenhouse gas emissions in America by 2030 may well be impossible, and the whole program could cost trillions. But activists like longtime environmental campaigner Ben Weiss say they have to aim high.
It's the role of outside organizations to push the system as far as it can go.
Sunrise wants to do that by assembling what it calls an army of youth to get supporters of the Green New Deal elected in 2020.
We're pissed off that our leaders have failed to do something about it.
Sunrise co-founder Varshini Prakash again.
And we're going to be left dealing with the repercussions of their inaction. So we have to be the ones to do it if anything's going to happen.
This outrage isn't unique to Americans. It's being echoed by young activists all over the world.
You are not mature enough to tell it like it is.
15-year-old Swedish climate activist Greta Thunberg stole the show at the recent UN climate talks in Poland.
We have not come here to beg world leaders to care. We have come here to let you know that change is coming, whether you like it or not.
This is a global fight, honestly, to protect the future of human civilization.
Varshini Prakash from Sunrise Movement again.
And I think that's how our generation really sees it, which is why we're seeing people rise up in every corner of the world.
The question now is whether the buzz surrounding the Green New Deal will lead to action in Washington. For The World, Carolyn Beeler.
Coming up on The World, U.S. air traffic controllers are not getting paychecks, so their Canadian colleagues are sending them pizza.
I can't imagine what it's like to be going to work in one of the most high-stress jobs in the world, where you got to be 100% correct 100% of the time and have to worry about how are you going to make your next mortgage payment or feed your family next week.
Canadian kindness on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Really, what a time we're living through. Today, the President of the United States was asked again, had he fallen under the influence of the Kremlin? And again, Trump tried to put it to rest. Here he is before getting on a helicopter at the White House.
I never worked for Russia, and you know that answer better than anybody. I never worked for Russia. Not only did I never work for Russia, I think it's a disgrace that you even asked that question, because it's a whole big fat hoax. It's just a hoax.
It's no hoax, though, as far as the FBI is concerned. Over the weekend, we learned from the New York Times that the Bureau opened an investigation in 2017, not long after Trump moved into the White House. An investigation focused on that very question, was Trump working for Russia? Also, the Washington Post reported over the weekend that Trump went to extraordinary lengths to conceal what he discussed in meetings with Russian President Vladimir Putin. That included Trump taking away his own interpreter's notes. We'll come back to that. First, Michael McFaul was U.S. ambassador in Moscow during the Obama administration. He's now at Stanford University. This, says McFaul, is how high-level meetings happened when he was ambassador.
The way it worked when I was in the administration, and I worked at the White House for 3 years before going to Moscow, we would agree what the objectives of the meeting was, the bilat, as we called it, the bilateral meeting between President Obama and Putin or President Medvedev. And then we would write up the talking points collectively that we all agreed. President Obama would then try to push forward our American national interests. And then there would be a readout of that, a memcom. I oftentimes was the note taker, by the way, when I worked at the White House. Mm. And then that memcom would go out to the senior officials in the administration so that they could know what had been achieved and what still had to be done. And, you know, I just want to underscore it's vital to advancing America's national interest as a collective and not just as an individual leader meeting with another individual leader.
You mean it's important to have a record of what happened in the meeting or the meetings themselves?
Yes, because think about it. After a meeting between President Trump and President Putin, or in my case, President Obama and President Putin, the Secretary of Defense is meeting with his counterpart in Russia, or the Secretary of State is meeting, you know, Clinton is meeting with Lavrov. They have to be able to have the same message. They have to be able to have the same approach that their boss did, that the president did. And so if there's not that communication, they're left kind of, you know, guessing as to what the policy is. And by the way, this is a problem that the Trump administration has shown many, many times with respect to the Russia policy. The administration seems to have one policy, and I would say it's a pretty robust confrontational policy. But President Trump personally seems to have another policy. And that disconnect, it's just not good for the American national interest.
When you were in Moscow, I saw you tweet about this, Michael McFaul. You said that you'd come out of meetings with Russian officials and you'd brief the president. You'd also quickly brief the press. Why is that so important?
Yes, we did it all the time. I did it as ambassador, and I did it when I worked at the White House. And that's because we wanted to shape the narrative about what the meeting was about, especially on contentious issues. So we would do that almost immediately after a meeting that President Obama had. And it's very striking how the Trump administration almost never does that. They leave it up to the Russians themselves.
So briefing the press, is that kind of pro forma in diplomatic circles, or briefing the press an especially important thing when you're dealing with Russia?
Well, I think it's pro forma. There are obviously certain things that get said in presidential meetings that need to be left between the presidents and between the governments. But it was, in my time at the White House especially, it was standard operating procedure that we always went and briefed the press after any high-level bilateral meeting, that is, with a meeting with a president or a prime minister of any country.
So let me push you here for a moment, Ambassador. From the point of view of Trump and his supporters, and frankly, even just thinking objectively for a moment, shouldn't the president have some leeway and the authority to have private meetings with foreign leaders?
Yes, if he can demonstrate that he's achieving American foreign policy objectives. If he had one-on-one meetings with Putin and we reduced nuclear weapons, we got Russia to leave Syria, we got them to stop violating sovereignty in Ukraine, I would applaud him. I would salute him. But there's no causal relationship between these one-on-one meetings and what I and many people in his own administration, by the way, would define as American objectives in U.S.-Russian relations right now.
How uncharted is the territory we're in here?
I don't know anything like it. And I want to be clear about what is uncharted for me. When you have a president who has a certain way of interacting with the Russians in a secretive way, one-on-one meetings, gathering up the notes of interpreters. I've never heard of anything like that in the history of the United States interacting with Russia. And the other piece that is unprecedented is the disconnect between the president and his approach to dealing with Vladimir Putin and the rest of his entire administration. That also is something I can't remember, you know, at any time in U.S.-Russian relations.
Michael McFaul was U.S. ambassador to Russia from 2012 to 2014. Always good to speak with you. Thank you.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
It was in 2017 when Trump met with Putin in Hamburg, Germany. After that meeting, Trump reportedly took his interpreter's notes and then told his interpreter not to talk about what she heard, even with officials from his own administration. That has raised questions and has put the interpreter, her name is Marina Gross, in the spotlight. Yulia Tsaplina is a Russian interpreter who's worked in high-level political meetings. She's based in Paris. I asked her what she thinks about the fact that Trump's interpreter now finds herself in the middle of a political fight.
Personally, I think she's in a very delicate situation right now. I would not want to be in her shoes. I don't think it is right to draw the attention to the interpreter, because the interpreter is only there to relay the words of the principals in the meeting and not in her own personal capacity.
Right. So I'm curious, what might be in the notes of any interpreter at a meeting, attending a meeting like Trump-Putin? Is it just what is said, or are there kind of side notes on maybe body language or anything else that is observed?
Oh, no, there wouldn't be any kind of notes about body language. This is not a transcript of the conversation. What we take down in notes is what will help us to remember what was just said. It has no value long term. Our notes are full of symbols, abbreviations, and these symbols and abbreviations may not make sense to us just a few days after the meeting.
And so what would be your process typically after a meeting? Do you then have to kind of share your notes with somebody else, a higher up perhaps?
Usually not. I have been in situations when my clients would ask me to give them my notes, which I would do immediately. I don't know what they would do with them. I think this stems from concern over confidentiality, but as interpreters, we are not to disclose anything that was discussed at the meeting. So I've had a couple of situations in my professional career when I had to surrender my notes to the people who were at the meeting, not to anyone else, not to anyone outside of the meeting. And I would never give my notes to anyone outside of the meeting.
Do you have to keep secrets when you're in these sorts of meetings? Is that also kind of the deal?
Oh, absolutely. That's part and parcel of the profession. We have our code of ethics. We have international associations of conference interpreters. And the code of ethics is very clear. I believe it's Article 2A that says that we are all members of the association are bound by a strict secrecy, which must be observed towards all persons and with regards to all information. So we are not at liberty to discuss anything that was said.
So Marina Gross took notes, and now the Democrats here in the States want to use a subpoena to get a hold of them. What do you think about that? Is there a problem there for you?
As a member of the profession, yes. As a citizen of the country, I would also be very curious to know what was discussed at the meeting. But as an interpreter, I know that on the one hand, it would be completely useless because no one would be able to decipher those notes. It has been, 6 months since the meeting? No interpreter is going to remember or reproduce with any kind of accuracy.
Yeah, well, you just said that a few days later, you would have forgotten what the notes actually meant.
Precisely. Because the symbols that we use, the abbreviation that we use, they may be meeting specific. So we wouldn't necessarily remember. It is there as a short-term memory aid. And secondly, that flies in the face of the tenets of our profession, that really undermines trust in interpretation as a profession. So I think it would set a very dangerous precedent.
Yulia Saplina, a Russian interpreter based in Paris, thank you for your time and for explaining this to us.
My pleasure.
The American president has a great deal of authority, but not when it comes to the records from the meetings he attends. Tom Blanton is director of the non-governmental National Security Archive at George Washington University, and he says it's against the law for a president to conceal or get rid of those records.
The Presidential Records Act, which Congress passed back in 1978, was meant to deal precisely with this because Richard Nixon had said, no, all those Watergate tapes, they're my personal property. I can do anything I want to with them. And Congress said, nope, that's not right. If you're working for the taxpayer, the records belong to the taxpayer. Where the big disputes are is how much review the courts can have over what the president does and how much people like us at the National Security Archive can intervene. We got a lawsuit right now about the White House visitor logs because this business with the interpreter's notes is not the first time President Trump has tried to push the envelope, shall we say, or rip up the envelope.
I mean, Nixon and his tapes are a great example of this. So what does the Presidential Records Act say about consequences for a president who doesn't follow the law?
It's really up to the Congress, unfortunately, and this Congress has shown very little backbone to enforce consequences. The National Archives, the government agency, has been a bit of an orphan agency. Folks like us have had to sue them to get them to intervene. The president can't destroy records without the permission of the Archivist of the United States. And the Archivist of the United States is supposed to bring in the Attorney General to take action and stop. But courts have been really scared to say, wait a second, at the very least, the court should review. This interpreter's notes question, though, it gets even more interesting because the parallel of Nixon is right on target. Nixon and Kissinger were pretty famous for creating multiple versions of a transcript of a conversation with a foreign official so that they would make one version was complete and that would stay only in a White House safe or in Kissinger's safe.
Wow.
Another would be more of a summary with kind of the cuss words cut out that could be shared with the State Department. Another would be like a one-page gist and they'd share that with the Defense Department. And so for historians who've been putting together those conversations, the tapes really helped because they showed the full Monty, if you will, and then all these partial versions that we've resurrected, you kind of see a consistent pattern of deceit. Trump's effort to prevent even a transcript or so-called memorandum of conversation from being available at all is beyond the pale.
So what records exactly are referred to in the Presidential Records Act? Like the interpreter's notes from the president's meeting with Putin? Would that fall under this act?
Sure, absolutely. And something at that very high level of the president's own words and a foreign leader's words would be at the heart of what the Presidential Records Act is about. Here, it's unclear what Trump is conspiring at. It's almost as if, I don't know, the metaphor that comes to mind to me is not an analogy to other presidents because we have never had a president like Trump. It's more like a mafia don. It's kind of you only trust the people who are in your family. You don't want anybody else really to know what's going on or what you're saying or what promises you're making to foreign governments. The most amazing thing to me about Trump's foreign relations has been we the American public have found out more about his conversations with those guys from those governments. Putin's the foreign ministry spokesman over there in Moscow, will put out a readout on the conversation that's more detailed than anything Sarah Huckabee Sanders gives the folks at the White House.
Tom, is Congress eventually just going to have to step up and deal with this? I mean, and especially regarding this meeting in Hamburg and what we know happened in it or what we don't know.
Exactly. I think both the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and the House Foreign Affairs Committee are going to have to hold hearings where they pull in those top senior officials and get them on the record. What do you know? What do you not know? What were you told? What records did you get to see? And that poor interpreter may end up in the crosshairs. What's she going to do, right? The president told her one thing, but the Congress has a constitutional obligation to know what's going on in foreign policy. But I would even say the courts are going to have to step up. We went through this after 9/11, where President George W. Bush said the courts don't have a role in judging anything about the war on terror. It's all up to the commander in chief. But finally, I think it was Sandra Day O'Connor who stepped up and said, wait a second, courts get to review whether the executive is obeying and faithfully carrying out the law. And I think we're still on the hunt for a federal judge with some backbone who will stand up and say, look, you can't do that. You can't delete records. You can't hide the record of a conversation. You can't tear up these documents on your desk and leave them under your table. That's just wrong.
Tom Blanton, the director of the Nongovernmental National Security Archive at George Washington University. Thanks very much for your time today.
Thank you, Marco.
Marco Werman here with The World. And a random question for you. Where's the nearest merry-go-round? Here in Boston, we've got two that I know of. Hard to top Argentina's capital, Buenos Aires, though. They've got more than 60. Yeah, just think about the person who has to maintain them all. And yes, one single person has that job in Buenos Aires. The BBC's Colm Flynn visited the workshop of Leonel Bajo Moreno.
Leonel, great to meet you.
¿Cómo estás?
Bien, ¿cómo estás? Bienvenido. The workshop was started 30 years ago, so it's nearly as old as Leonel. He's 33. His grandfather, Hector, would work here day and night, building carousels. As a child, Leonel, when you were running around watching your grandfather work on these beautiful carousels, what do you remember about that? What was going through your mind?
Y tengo la imagen de cuando se iban tomando las medidas, por ejemplo, los carruseles.
I remember my granddad doing lots of measuring and lots of manual work. He started, let's say, with a big piece of metal. And then, in the space of a few months, I would witness that piece of metal being transformed into different shapes and eventually into a carousel. This process of building things left a mark on me.
Did you know then that this is what you wanted to do, that you wanted to follow in his footsteps?
No.
Not at all. I studied graphic design and I used to work at my computer all day. But I missed the workshop. I missed touching the materials.
And when his grandfather retired a few years ago, he quit his job in graphic design and took over the running of the workshop.
I wanted to modernize my granddad's workshop. And also there was a spiritual aspect to it. I grew up in this workshop. And seeing all these machines being abandoned made me sad. I wanted to bring life back into them.
What is it you love about what you do?
I lead a more peaceful life here in the workshop. And I get to work with my hands. Manual work calms my mind down. Also, I love the idea of being part of this extraordinary world.
Why do you think it is, Leonel, that all these years on, the carousel, that beautiful merry-go-round, still captivates people?
I think that carousels are almost mystical places. All the music and the spinning create small fantasy worlds that stimulate children's imagination, which is very important.
As we finish up our chat among the wood chips in the workshop, I feel a friendly tail hit my leg.
Este es mi perro Moro.
This is my dog Moro. He's a rescue dog, and we keep him here because we think he brings peace and tranquility to the workers.
Does Moro like carousels?
Sí, le tiene un poquito de miedo todavía. Es un perro medio miedo.
Sort of. He's a bit of a coward, this one.
Aw, carousel guru Leonel Bajo Moreno there, speaking with the BBC's Colm Flynn in Buenos Aires. And finally, it's day 24 for the longest government shutdown in U.S. history. For many furloughed federal workers, no paycheck means even something as mundane as buying groceries is suddenly a challenge. Some restaurants across the country are offering free meals, and this sort of generosity, it seems, extends beyond our borders. Air traffic control workers in Canada are now sending pizzas to their colleagues working without pay here in the U.S. as a sign of solidarity. We asked Peter Duffy how that started. Duffy is the president of the Canadian Air Traffic Control Association.
Well, this would be the absolute definition of a grassroots movement. It started in Edmonton when a group of controllers there wanted to show support to their American counterparts and sent some pizzas to Anchorage, Alaska, that part of the country where their airspace ends, Anchorage begins. So they talked to these people all day long on the coordination of the transborder flights. Word got out about that, and it has just spread like wildfire across the country. We have sent pizzas to 52 different FAA air traffic control facilities south of the border.
Wow. So who's paying for the pizza?
It's literally pass the hat. The people in the area control centers and the towers are passing the hat around. People are reaching into their pockets, putting the money in. This is the controllers themselves paying for this.
So the shutdown's been going on here in the States for more than 3 weeks. Is this something you and your colleagues have been talking about in the office, and do you see this continuing?
Absolutely. It's something that we've been talking about, not just here in Canada, but we have a fairly extensive global network of air traffic control unions, and there has been a tremendous amount of outpouring of support. I can't imagine what it's like to be going to work in one of the most high-stress jobs in the world, where you got to be 100% correct 100% of the time and have to worry about how you're going to make your next mortgage payment or feed your family next week.
I was going to ask you, I mean, how would you respond if you and your colleagues in Canada had to work without pay?
You can ask that question of just about anybody, Marco, that's working and say, how would you fare if all of a sudden you were told you're not going to get your paycheck for the next couple of weeks? The president is saying this could last for months or years. If that actually happened, you're probably going to see people walk away from that career. They won't have a choice. They'll have to find other employment. And this is a system that's already just strained with capacity because they already have a critical staffing shortage.
How stressful is the job of air traffic controller, and how distracted must a shutdown be for people who have these life and death responsibilities?
It is a high-stress career. There's no doubt about that. We have to be laser-focused when we're plugged in and working. But when you step away from the position and it's downtime, you know, you want to read a book, you may want to get on the internet and do some Facebook or whatever sort of takes your mind off things. Now on their breaks, they're probably having to call their banks, credit card companies, whoever they need to take care of business with without income coming in. And it's just got to be exhausting on them.
What kind of response then have you been getting from air traffic controllers in the U.S. to these pizzas that keep showing up in the towers?
It's absolutely been heartwarming. We've gotten a lot of tweets. We've gotten a lot of messages back on Facebook. I've personally received emails from people I know in the U.S. And the message is just overwhelming gratitude. One of thanks for brightening what was an otherwise very dull day at work. It's just been fantastic.
I mean, it is really impressive and heartwarming, this solidarity between air traffic controllers. You were alluding to this earlier. As an air traffic controller, are you often on headsets with your U.S. colleagues, and do Canadian air traffic controllers have friends over the wire?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. All day long, we have people communicating back and forth, talking to each other. There's a lot of things, social events that go on. We have curling bonspiels, hockey tournaments. Not just
so
between Canada and US.
If there's an American who knows how to curl, we can assume it's an air traffic controller.
And yeah, we usually beat you.
I'm not surprised.
And we're pretty,
to hear that.
We're pretty handy at the hockey tournament too up here.
Yeah, who pays for the pizzas then?
There's a real camaraderie and a real family feeling. When I was talking with the president of the U.S. Union yesterday, when he was expressing his thanks, he said a term which just hit it right on the head for me, two unions, one family, and that just sums it up.
Yeah, I'll say. Peter Duffy, the president of the Canadian Air Traffic Control Association, thanks very much. And thanks for the pizza.
Thanks, Marco.
Well, here's hoping the special pizza deliveries are not needed for much longer. And that'll do it for us on The World Today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman, back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.